KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Every year, the average American eats 70 pounds of sugar. The amounts of salt and fat are equally staggering. The processed food industry thrives, raking in $1 trillion a year. Meanwhile, the costs to our health include obesity and diabetes. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss talks about how companies use salt, sugar, and fat to get us addicted to their products, and what we can do to fight back. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15, 2013. The talk was moderated by Chip Giller, president and founder of Grist. Giller speaks first.
So, Michael, I just wanted to kick things off by asking, what did you eat for dinner tonight?
As my friends and sister pointed out, I had a lot of salt, sugar, and fat for dinner tonight. I can't go out with anybody anymore without them.
Sorry.
Endlessly joking.
Yes. I want to get to the thesis of the book shortly, but I also, the book is broadly about kind of weaponizing, the food industry's weaponizing of salt, sugar, and fat. But before we get into that, I just wondered if you could touch on your journey. I mean, what led you to devote 3.5 or 4 years of your life to this investigation? Were you just looking at a Dorito and wondering, where did this come from? What's in it?
And I'm actually going to end the journey with the last steps I took, because this was my first glimpse of this hall. And it's really, really elegant. I thank you so much for coming here and having this venue. And I'll tell you how rich it is for you, because I know that they're fundraising. Random House, I used to live in San Francisco for 10 years, and Random House declined to even think about sending me to San Francisco because they don't have a venue like this. San Francisco doesn't know books like Seattle and doesn't have a place like this. There you go. My journey on this book, I mean, the long story is I had been traveling to Iraq in the Middle East, as they mentioned, and had to come back home. We were sitting around, me and my editor, Christine Kay, in the cafeteria of the New York Times in Manhattan on the 14th floor, and she said to me one word, and it was peanuts. And you have to know Christine Kay a little bit to know that she's one of those editors who has such a nose for news that I've learned to listen to her. And a factory in southern Georgia near the Alabama border had allowed its peanuts to be tainted by salmonella. 8 people died, an estimated 19,000 people got sick in 43 states. And as I dug into it, and as companies recalled thousands of separate products around the country that had used these peanuts, I realized that the huge thing there was that they had lost control of their ingredients. They were buying peanuts as an ingredient and other ingredients from hundreds of vendors and not taking some obvious steps to control the safety of that. My next reporting took me to Minnesota, where Cargill had made hamburger that was tainted with E. coli. And again, the issue was sort of lack of control. And I was working on another story about contamination when one of my most trusted sources inside the food industry, who lives here in Seattle, said to me, you know, Michael, as tragic as these incidents of contamination are, there's another public health crisis afoot that involves things that we, my industry, intentionally puts into our products and over which we have absolute control. And that was the start of this book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. And I'm here 3 years later to tell you that he was really right.
So tell us about the book. You almost describe these ingredients as almost like heroin-like in certain ways, addictive in nature. Are they really that addictive? And what do you mean when you talk about the food industry weaponizing these ingredients?
Sure. I mean, there's no word that the food industry hates more than the A word, addictive. They prefer things like alluring or craveable or snackable. But yes, you know, addictiveness is there. And one of the important things to say right up front is that I don't view these companies as evil empires, you know, intent on getting us obese and ill. The problem, and none of their products, too, individually, can be blamed for the situation we're in with obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease, including soda or potato chips, my favorite of all. We'll get a potato chips tonight. You'll find out why they're so snackable. The problem lies in their collective zeal as companies. They do what companies do. They make as much money as they can by selling as much product as they can. And the problem also lies in their dependence on salt, sugar, and fat to make their products utterly convenient, low cost, and fantastically, irresistibly tasty. And I think that's one of the fundamental issues that we can talk about here tonight, as in my book. And everything that they do, from the formulation to the marketing to the advertising, is driven not at getting people to like our product. It's driven at getting people to eat more and more of our product.
Aren't they just giving us consumers what we want, though?
Sorry to say that.
Aren't they just giving us consumers what we want?
Are they? Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. But let me walk you through one example. So I met a legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz, trained in math and then experimental psychology at Harvard. He has created some of the biggest icons out there for all of the big companies. He walked me through one of his recent creations of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper. And to do that, he used 61 separate flavorings of sweetness, each just slightly different than the other, and he subjected those to more than 3,000 consumer taste testings in cities around the country, and then took all the data, dumped it into his computer, did his high regression math analysis thing, and came up with the very perfect amount of sweetness that was guaranteed to make that soda a hit and send us over the moon when we drank it. And he explained to me that our liking for sugar is not infinite, and we all kind of know this, and you can do this experiment with your coffee if you like sugar in it, add sugar until you get to the point where you like it the most, and then if you add more, eventually you'll get to the yuck point. This is like too much. And it looks like a bell-shaped curve. There's some kids here in the audience who know about the grading curve in school. It looks like that. And the very top of that curve is where the optimum amount. And he has a word for that. He helped coin it years and years ago. It's called the bliss point for sugar. And not only soda, but bread and pasta sauce and so many items now in the store which are sweet and which never used to be sweet all have a bliss point that's precisely engineered, is their word, by scientists working for the food companies.
Yeah, I love that term, bliss point. There were a couple other terms that just sort of stuck with me. One of them was mouthfeel.
Yeah.
What does that mean, mouthfeel?
So mouthfeel relates to fat, because fat is not one of the five basic tastes. It's a sense, and I like to think of it as a sense of that warm, gooey sensation you get biting into a hot toasted cheese sandwich. It's actually a nerve ending that comes down almost to the roof of your mouth that sends signals to the brain's pleasure center, just as sugar does and salt does through the taste buds, through this nerve that says to you, Michael, eat more of that cheesy sandwich.
Well, let me toss one more at you. This one I'm having trouble pronouncing, but it was sensory-specific satiety,
yeah,
which I guess relates to the bliss point.
Yes.
But just the fact that these terms exist.
Yeah.
So that's unpack that one.
I love the terminology, and it was so, I mean, we talked before about how this the research and writing for this book for me was like being inside a detective story, able to spend time with these scientists in this industry who speak their own language. And yeah, bliss point, mouthfeel, sensory specific satiety is a weird one for the industry. It basically goes like this: that, you know, a really strong tasting food like turkey tetrazzini will compel you to really ravish it for the first few bites or the first meal. but you're going to get tired of it really fast because it has an overriding taste. Whereas something like white bread, you can eat forever and ever and not get tired of it. And this is sort of a quandary that's been for in the processed food industry. And it sort of explains why so much of their food in some ways is really bland. That's designed to keep your brain from going, had enough of that, don't want it again. The epitome, the master of sensory-specific satiety and avoiding that is none other than Coca-Cola, which has all of these ingredients along with the sugar. But after you drink it, and they like to think of it as a nice, well-balanced wine, but hey, look, you're not thinking of any one specific flavor. And so hours later, when you get that craving for another Coke, you're not going to run from it because, oh, yeah, I remember the vanilla and I had too much of that vanilla. It's like, it's just perfectly balanced. And that's the height of achievement for the food industry. All the food companies, by the way, just adore Coca-Cola. They are
worshipful.
The top of the... Worship them, yes.
So there were so many wonderful, it's not quite the right word for it, but so many fascinating stories in the book about kind of products that were developed and then brought to market. And I thought to sort of illustrate much of the book, we could talk about one of my favorites, which was Lunchables.
Oh, yeah.
So how did Lunchables come about? What was the need that it was serving for the company? And what was the perceived need for the consumer?
1987, Oscar Mayer, Madison, Wisconsin, was starting to have a problem, and it was called red meat. People were eating less red meat in this country because of saturated fat, which is the type of fat that's linked to heart disease, and salt. Oscar Mayer wanted to do something to jumpstart sales. They brought in some of their smartest people, including Bob Drain, a marketer who I spent time with, and he walked me through the whole process. He came in and with his team came up with this idea of creating a TV dinner type tray. First he was targeting moms who worked outside the home, and then they targeted kids using bologna, cheese. They wanted to use bread, but they couldn't. That wouldn't sit on the shelf forever, so they ended up with crackers in this cool little tray. And very quickly on in the process, they realized that it really wasn't about the food, especially when they came up with the pizza Lunchable and then the hamburger Lunchable and the hot dog Lunchable, all of which are utterly cold and almost, you know, have no resemblance to the real thing you buy at McDonald's or Pizza Hut. But they realized that for the kids who they were targeting with the Lunchables, it was about empowerment, and they came up with the slogan, maybe some of you remember it, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. And the Lunchables to the kids became this badge of independence, and it was just a huge marketer. They're approaching $1 billion in sales.
Yeah, so it takes off, and it's sort of a win in a sense for Oscar Mayer, but in fact it's losing money. I mean, I forget what it is, but in year one, they make $100 million, but gross, but they're losing, they're netting negative $10 million. So the dude goes up to, is it owned by Philip Morris?
Yes. Definitely.
Goes to the executive of Philip Morris and says, he's afraid he's almost going to be punished for launching this thing that's losing money. Yeah. And then what happens?
And I should say the Philip Morris executives were known for their corporate product meetings, and I was lucky enough to come across a trove of documents that took me inside these meetings. They would have not only to discuss cigarettes and beer, they had a beer company, but also food, because, and we can talk about this a bit more too, but Philip Morris became the largest food manufacturer in North America through its acquisition of the old food company General Foods and then Kraft. And Lunchables, and then became its product because Oscar Mayer was part of the General Foods company, and the Philip Morris leadership was known for making just incredibly smart, quick decisions. There was one meeting where the manager from Australia was there, and he had a new Marlboro pack, and he kind of threw it on the table and said, "Here's the old pack," and here's the new pack, and millions of dollars were at stake, and the CEO of Philip Morris just goes, "Yeah, okay, we get it. Next item. And so Lunchables inventor Bob Drain flies to New York, convinces with his data that the Lunchables has legs. He has incredible sales data from the first year, and he convinces them it's going to keep on. And he's pleading for money because he wants to expand the manufacturing lines and grow it. And the CEO of Philip Morris at the time says, "Yeah, I get it. I mean, you've done the hard part of finding something that will sell. You'll figure out the cost structure. You'll swap this ingredient for that ingredient. You'll get rid of the silly little napkin that was in there, and that'll save a couple pennies. Don't worry about that. You've done the genius work of plumbing the psyche of the American consumer and finding something that will sell."
Michael Moss, the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Michael Moss in a moment. 822 94.9 KUOW. Three Canadian senators have been ordered to pay back taxpayers' money they wrongly expensed, plus interest. Also, Atlantic Canada lobster fishermen say they're barely breaking even, and in protest, hundreds have refused to set their traps. One Newfoundland resident wants to take care of her severely disabled son with the help of her province. And after 100,000 blueprints for 3D guns are downloaded, an Ontario printer states their views on the future of the controversial firearm. All these items tonight in the 11 o'clock hour. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 50, mostly clear. Friday highs 70s to lower 80s, mostly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 50. Partly cloudy in the evening, becoming mostly cloudy, and Saturday highs down into the 70s and partly sunny.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Without salt, sugar, and fat, the processed food industry would cease to exist. Millions of Americans are hooked on these foods, and companies take advantage of this addiction. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Moss launched an investigation into some of the major offenders, including Kraft, Coca-Cola, Kellogg, and Nestle. Moss spoke about his research at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15, 2013. The talk was moderated by Chip Giller, president and founder of Grist. Giller speaks first.
So I'm just kind of curious, who were the people with whom you were having these? Who were the sources in the food industry, and why were they willing to speak to you? Because, as you said, you uncovered kind of troves of documents, but you were able to bring the stories to light via these personalities. Who were these people? What was motivating them?
You know, it sort of depended on the person. Howard Moskowitz, who I mentioned on the soda, loves to talk about his work, it's just so fascinating to sit down and talk to him about it. You know, a good number of them have come to regret their work in some sense. I mean, to their defense, things like the Lunchables was invented in a more innocent era when our dependence on these ultra-processed foods was much less than it was today, and they came to see our deepening dependence with regret. And so instead of, you know, people eating a Lunchables once a month, you know, eating them once a day, something like that, you know, having a very different sort of connotation. And some of it was just these people, you know, leaving their company and seeing for the first time what they had been doing. And the epitome of that is the former president for North America and Latin America of Coca-Cola, Jeffrey Dunn, who I spent time with. He worked at Coca-Cola for 20 years. His dad worked there. His whole life was Coca-Cola.
His whole aspiration was to grow up and work at Coke.
His whole aspiration. Yeah. He was one of their fiercest warriors. He walked me through the way Coca-Cola targets kids the way they pioneered the supersize me phenomena, the way they call their best customers, not customers, but heavy users. These are the 20% of the customers who drink 80% of the Coke, and as they explained to me, it made much more economic sense to target them to maintain their heavy use rather to spend too much money getting the 80% to drink a little bit more.
Just to interrupt, I want to get to Jeffrey Dunn, but a heavy user, just to put give people a sense of how much, that's like 1,000 Cokes a year or something
yes.
like that?
Yep, 3 Cokes yeah. a day, 1,000 yeah. 1,000 a year, it's a lot. That's
to
a
qualify, lot. There's probably extra heavy users, but yes.
Yes, no, I'm sure there are people more than that. Jeffrey Dunn had this moment of epiphany. He was in Brazil with his managers. They were showing off their latest strategy for selling Coca-Cola to the emerging middle class in the favelas, in the poor neighborhoods of Brazil, of Rio, I think is where he was. And he said he heard a voice out of the sky say, look, these kids need a lot of things in their life, but another Coca-Cola or a Coca-Cola is probably not one of them. He came back to Coke. He tried to do some things to nudge the company in a healthier direction. He left, and I caught up with him years later in California, where he was working for one of the two big carrot farms in the country, selling, and here's the great part, selling fresh baby carrots, having stolen a page of the playbook from the junk food marketing industry, on the notion that if we just spent a little more time pitching carrots to kids like we pitch Oreos to kids, we can help level the playing field in the store. Anyway, to get to your answer, you know, Jeffrey felt that in doing this, he was addressing his karmic debt, as he called it, his 20 years at Coca-Cola. So it just kind of goes on and on like that. A number of these executives, food scientists, marketing officials, I mean, a lot of them don't eat their own products.
I was really sort of stunned
to realize that, especially when they run into health trouble. I spent time with a former top scientist at Kraft who blew out his knee. He usually ran for exercise, couldn't do that anymore, and he immediately stopped drinking anything with calories in it, because there is some science that says our brains are less apt to detect calories in liquids than in solid foods. And then he stopped eating his favorite food, which was potato chips, because he was one of those people who would go home after work, have a martini, and then open a bag of chips and couldn't stop with that little tiny thing they call a serving on the back of the package. He would eat the whole bag, and he knew he had to not open it in the first place. And the supermarket for him became a bit of a minefield as he was trying to watch his weight without having a way of otherwise of burning
off. But this really was a repeated theme. You would ask your sources,
yeah, then it became
do you
really
consume
fun.
Your product?
Yeah, then it became really fun. Well, what do you eat? The former top scientist at Frito-Lay in the late 70s, early 80s, who's actually on the cover of the, we'll show you the magazine excerpt, is his quote. I went to see him in Southern California. We sat around looking at all these great documents he had saved from the company relating to his battle over salt way back when, sitting at his dining room table, and he served me plain oatmeal and raw asparagus for lunch. And I thought he was putting me on, so I managed to like move the conversation into his kitchen, and we, can we look in the cupboards? And he had not one piece of processed food in his house. On the other hand, he was in his 70s, and that morning he had done his usual jog, hour-long jog, up this hill behind his house, so maybe he's got something there.
So did you leave this investigation basically seeing strong parallels between the sort of tobacco industry and those fights and what might be emerging in the food industry? And it's also, I mean, it's just interesting that Philip Morris then became this food giant.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, do you see those parallels really strongly? And
yeah, I did going into this into the reporting. And especially when I found out about Philip Morris, which I really hadn't known, and I expected them to be doing everything, in their power to do. And for the first couple decades, that's what they did. They coaxed and nudged and loaned some of their own marketing tools and strategy to their food division managers for instance, how to pitch snack foods better to convenience stores, which they were masterful of at with their cigarettes. But one of the surprises with Philip Morris and one of the arcs in the book, not to give it away, is that they had a change of mind, if not heart. And starting in the late 90s, Philip Morris came under huge regulatory pressure, legal pressure. They were worried. They were constantly polling for public opinion, and their polls were plummeting, and they were worried about losing the whole shebang in the public trust. They became the first tobacco company to embrace government regulation as a way to save something of the company. And when they did that, they turned to their food division, which was bringing in 51% of their profits, and they said, you know, you guys are going to face as great, if not greater, danger from salt, sugar, fat, and obesity as we are right now from nicotine. And you've got to start rethinking your dependence on those three ingredients, which was just sort of a stunning sort of moment that here's Washington, you know, declining to intervene in a meaningful way on these nutrition issues, and yet the tobacco industry is there warning the food company. That was a really startling thing.
So where is the U.S. government in this? I mean, we have an FDA, the Department of Agriculture. Aren't they there to protect the consumer's interests?
You know,
I'm asking naively.
The Agriculture Department especially is so conflicted with its missions. They're, you know, they will spend tens of millions and millions of dollars, you know, on behalf of one of their obligations, which is to support American agriculture and the food industry. And then there's this tiny, and by the way, the Agriculture Department is this huge building on the Mall, not very far from the Washington Monument in Washington, a fantastic structure with miles and miles of corridors and thousands of rooms. And then there's this little unit within the Agriculture Department whose budget is $6.5 million for its entire budget. And to find them, you have to get on the metro and journey across the Potomac to Virginia and then take a bus and then walk and go up to the 10th floor. And you'll find their mission is to protect us, the consumers, and to help advise us on what not to eat, on nutrition. That's the imbalance at the... But to get to your question, really, I mean, in many ways, the food industry is more powerful than the government agencies that are supposedly there to regulate them. And one of my favorite examples, as probably you know already, is cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk cheese.
Let's talk cheese. All right. Americans are eating, on average, as much as 33 pounds of cheese a year, now triple what we used to in the 70s. And we got there because the U.S. Department of Agriculture incentivized the dairy industry to make so much cheese, it began piling up, believe it or not, in caves in Missouri, because that was a cheap place to store it all. And believe it or not, the guy who came to Washington and put his foot down in 1980, Ronald Reagan. His Secretary of Agriculture was aghast at this. He said, no more, we're not buying any more of this cheese. It's going moldy. But they wouldn't abandon the dairy industry. So they came up with a scheme that enabled the dairy industry to raise tens of millions of dollars every year to effect the solution, which was to get you and me and all of you eating more cheese. And this is, there's probably some cheesemakers in this audience. This is not that kind of cheese that you eat before a meal as an hors d'oeuvre for its great taste. This is cheese that's also cheese that's added into food as an additive for the extra allure. Go to the dairy aisle these days, and cheese is there, not just sold in blocks or slices. It's in bulging with bags of diced and shredded and stringed and cubed and tubbed cheese to make it easier for you as home cooks to slip it into your recipes. And then you walk down the aisle and you see things like frozen pizza that has four cheeses on top and two more stuffed into the crust. it's there for that mouthfeel. And unfortunately, on the nutrition side, cheese is loaded with saturated fat. It's now the number one source of saturated fat in the American diet.
So the government has been almost more than complicit, but almost helped to create some of these circumstances.
Well, and it goes, it's even worse than that, Chip, because, you know, back, the problem originated back in the 1960s when people began drinking less whole milk as a way of cutting down
right.
on their saturated fat and calorie intake. So we thought we were getting rid of saturated fat, and then almost invisibly it's snuck back into our diets in the form of this cheese as additive cheese.
And does the FDA have a role here? And it seems to me the FDA has been a little more active, but not fully engaged.
Yeah, I mean, starting in the 90s, look, the FDA began requiring companies to actually put the fine print on the package telling us what you were eating. And that was like a tremendous victory for nutritionists. Up until then, we had no idea. You know, I ran across scientists who had to do studies about kids' cereal back in the 70s and 80s because nobody knew how much sugar was in there, and they found they were as much as 70% sugar. So, yes, the FDA has done certain things. One huge thing they haven't done, though, if you look at the nutrition facts box on the side or box or the end, back of the label, there's one glaring hole, and it's for sugar. It will tell you how many grams of sugar in the product, but it won't tell you whether that sugar was added or was natural to, because even tomatoes have a certain amount of sugar. And it also won't give you a recommended amount of sugar to have per day. You have no idea. Food nutrition activists are really now pressing the FDA hard to finally put some number on that so we have guidance, because there's guidance on saturated fat,
right.
There's guidance on salt and calories, but not...
Not to humiliate and call out my wife, who's in the audience, Jenny, but when I read your book, I was stunned. I mean, I think there was a scientist or someone who recommended that a daily allowance for a moderately active woman would be something like 5 teaspoons, which equates to half a Coke,
yeah.
Half a Coke or a Fig Newton and a half a day.
Yeah,
which it's just a different scale from what America.
It's pretty stunningly low, and I have to preface that in the book that look, I mean, a lot of nutrition science is really mushy. You know, these companies and regulators don't do double-blind, randomized trials like they do in the pharmaceutical industry, so nobody can stand up and say sugar causes. Has caused the diabetes crisis, or that salt is, you know, definitively responsible for this. And for me, as a reporter, one of the beautiful things in this detective story is that it became clear to me early on that the food industry itself was acknowledging responsibility for these things, and so I didn't have to reach out and problem. They acknowledge that salt, sugar, and fat in the amounts that they're using is indeed problematic.
So what's the way out of this bind we find ourselves in? So we have an industry that's sort of aware of it, some actors in the agency wishing to do things differently. We have increasing consumer awareness, but it's like an arms race. Like the individual companies can't really disarm. I mean, like I'm thinking about example, you know, and there was sort of a challenge this week, but Mayor Bloomberg's efforts in New York, I'm curious what you think about those around trans fats and the large sodas, and is that sort of the future, legislating or regulating or what?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're looking sort of at going one of two ways. One is to sort of tax the overeaten bad stuff. The other is to, and I think maybe a more interesting way, and I happen to know that the White House is looking at this, which is to try to shift some of the existing subsidies of processed food that Michael Pollan has written so eloquently about over to the things that everybody, including the government, says we should eat more of, fresh fruits and vegetables, which get almost no subsidies and are inherently more expensive. So even when we go into the grocery store with well-meaning intention to spend more time in the fruits and vegetable aisles, it's going to hit us in the pocketbook. So that's sort of one way out that I'm seeing. Any solution of government intervention is going to be imperfect, and you're going to get accusations of the nanny state. But I was really struck by a former CEO, Philip Morris, who was doing the nudging of Kraft back in the early 2000s, who gave me an interview and said to me, look, Michael, I'm no friend of government regulation, believe me. But the situation we're talking about here with the food industry is such that they are so fiercely competitive, these companies, that unless they were able to collectively get together and do something meaningful all together, they'll just eat each other alive in the grocery store. This may well be a situation that would call for government intervention, he says, Mr. Philip Morris, that CEO Philip Morris, that if only for one reason, which it would give them cover from Wall Street. Because when these companies do try to do the right thing by consumers, and they have, Wall Street is there breathing down their necks, looking at sales, and if sales flag, they will force them to reverse course, and if they've taken out salt, add salt back in. That is the 800-pound gorilla in this mm-hmm. equation, mm-hmm. along with consumers, along with the companies themselves, and government regulators.
I thought there was sort of with the soda ban that was at least temporarily overturned this week in New York, there was this sort of an interesting angle that a lot of the communities were challenges of obesity are the greatest, and some of the African American communities and Latino communities, the some of the larger chapters of the NAACP had come out against the ban. And could you tease out some of the connections there?
I was really, really surprised by that, I have to say, because that was very mindful of the tobacco days when there was a strong feeling that the tobacco companies were doing their heaviest marketing in the most vulnerable neighborhoods. And I can say this, that for the book, I spent some time in one of the poorest, formerly most violent neighborhoods in Philadelphia, where I met the principal of a school, very poor performing school, and she had come in to improve the academics, and immediately realized that she also had to work on the diet of her students. They were coming in every morning strung out on snack foods, jittery, unable to focus. She looked around the school. She was improving the school lunch, but she looked around the school and she realized it was ringed with corner stores that were purposely situated there. And they were luring the kids in on their way to school, offering sodas, snack cakes, salty chips, penny candy, all situated right up front in the store. They could buy for $1.06. Somebody did a study. 350 empty calories, and they'd eat those going into the school. And she did this intervention. She rallied the parents of this poor neighborhood who were trained by a group that used to fight crack houses. They organized these parents to stand outside the corner stores and try to deflect the kids as they tried to rush in there and explain to them a little bit of nutrition. And the reason they're doing it is that the home economics program system in this country fell by the wayside. You know, both girls and boys used to be taught how to shop, how to cook, how to think about food, how to be mindful about food. And that fell apart in the 70s and 80s, especially as the obesity crisis was beginning. And I was just really, really struck and impressed by these folks, you know, with minimal means paying, you know, deciding that it was incumbent upon them to, in essence, fight these food giants. Because all these companies come to the corner stores and deliver their snack foods, put them on the shelf, make sure they're in the best position to be there for the kids.
Regarding obesity in the White House and the administration, I'm curious what you think of the First Lady's, I have to swoon when I say her name, but Michelle Obama's efforts with the Let's Move campaign. And is that having an effect, or could it have more of an effect?
You know, I mean, hats off to her for that and bringing food sort of into the public conversation. And certainly exercise is part of it. I mean, how much? I mean, there's been some really good research recently pointing out that one needs to run at a really pretty good pace for an hour to burn off the calories in, you know, a little muffin, for example. So exercise is not going to solve the problem, but the food industry, and the food industry loves, you know, the exercise part of the equation, because it shifts the burden and responsibility onto us. Where I think the First Lady runs into problems, though, is pushing the industry to make meaningful changes in the way they formulate and market their foods. And I think there's only one thing that's going to do that, which is if the companies are held accountable for what they're doing. Ultimately, that it has to come down to that.
Michael Moss, the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Michael Moss in a moment, 846 94.9 KUOW. In Seattle, the King Street station was recently renovated with the help of funds from the federal government. But starting in October, the federal government is cutting its funding to Amtrak lines that are less than 750 miles long. The effects of that change will be felt in Washington State. We'll talk about that with Ron Pate, Director of the Passenger Rail Division of the Washington State Department of Transportation and Director of the Amtrak Cascades Rail Line that spans from Eugene, Oregon to Vancouver, B.C. That'll be in the noon hour tomorrow. Lows around 50 tonight, mostly clear. Friday highs, 70s to lower 80s, mostly sunny. Friday night lows around 50, partly cloudy in the evening, becoming mostly cloudy. Saturday highs in the 70s, partly sunny skies. A look at the advantages and disadvantages of burning wood pellets for heating. Also, journalist and author Neil Thompson talks about his book, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. And a look at programs in Washington State that help people with disabilities like autism, cerebral palsy, and Down syndrome find and keep jobs. All next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15, 2013. The talk was moderated by Chip Giller, president and founder of Grist. Giller speaks first.
Yeah, so just to end this portion of the evening with a little bit of uplift, a strain for uplift, I'm wondering, like, we as consumers in the audience and in the room here, what are a couple, two or three things that we could do as, I guess, consumers, other than just don't eat processed foods, and what could we do as citizens to try to push for change?
Right. Certainly in my family, we're not about to give up processed foods and can't. My wife, Eve, works outside the home, as do I. I have two boys, Will and Aaron, 8 and 13, and they are my walking bliss points for sugar. As we know, every one of their 10,000 taste buds is hardwired for sugar. But we have learned that you can work with these kids. They're reasonable and they're smart and they don't want to be ill. And Eve said to them not long ago, hey guys, okay, you love cereal. Let's try to limit ourselves to cereal that has 5 grams of sugar per half cup serving. And it's become a bit of like an Easter egg for them when they go shopping with us because they'll pick up the box and they've learned to look for the nutrition label and they'll look down for the amount of sugar. And they've also learned that, you know, they were going to probably have to reach low, or they're going to have to get me to reach high to find those lower sugar foods, because part of the issue in the grocery store is that the most heavily loaded products are strategically placed at eye level. They've put devices on shoppers' heads to measure their eye movements as you go into the store, and they know that when you first go to the aisle, you're not looking up close or distant, you're looking at the middle part of the aisle at eye level, and that's where they put the biggest sellers, which are the products that are most loaded. But that's one way that we're engaging our own kids in a way that doesn't seem too heavy-handed. I mean, a couple other things. It's really true that making a list and sticking to it is like a huge way to gain control of the food that you're buying in the store, because everything they're doing, and I report on the story, the studies that they funded in the book. Everything they're doing is to try to get you to make spontaneous decisions where you haven't thought about it ahead of time. And so, you know, they'll park the soda cooler at the checkout stand, so it's just so tempting to be right there. So, you know, form habits, stick to those, you know, try to limit your kids in sort of a reasonable way, spend more time in the fruits and vegetable aisle. I also like to say, everybody knows to look at the, all you folks know to look at the facts box of the fine print, but I like to say, you know, start with the front of the package, because that's where the, you know, the advertising is, and the come-ons and the touts. That's where you'll see the big letters, low, you know, low fat. And if it's a yogurt, you'll turn it over and you'll go, God, this has as much sugar in it as ice cream per serving. So I love to say, you know, really start with the front of the package. And then overall, I mean, I'm hoping that this book, and sort of, is, you know, as readers getting inside the food industry and knowing everything that you're they're throwing at you, for me, was incredibly empowering. And it's kind of knowing that I felt I was able to walk into the store and be more in control, because ultimately we're the ones who decide what to buy and how much to eat.
Okay, so I lied. I said that would be my last question, but just I do want to encourage everyone to actually buy the book, because it's such an awesome book. And so just my last question is, you were telling me in the back room, just sort of, I mean, these covers are just really quite, have stories behind them. So Michael's piece was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine 3 or 4 weeks ago at this point, and I think it's been one of the most, if not the most read piece in the magazine's history online. But each of these covers, and you were just telling me about a third that came out, and you know, books are kind of a collaboration. You had some amazing artists help with this, so maybe you could...
Yeah, my third favorite cover was on the cover of Der Spiegel last week. They took what looked like a cigarette pack and stuffed it with French fries and then put a warning on the front. And my German is a little rusty, but about, you know, a warning, this food could be dangerous to your health. This is my favorite cover. God bless Random House. They had another perfectly fine cover. And then they found this wonderful Russian artist upstate in New York who went into the grocery store, pulled down all his favorite foods he hates to love, and clipped the letters out of it and rearranged them, you know, in what the book was doing, which is, you know, to reveal really what was inside the package and what should be on the front of the package.
And then this, there was a whole piece, there was like a follow-up.
Yeah,
piece.
And this is a very famous model who does all of the mouth sort of finger photography. She's done probably hundreds, and you can go to the New York Times Magazine blog to read about her work.
It's her point of pride. These are her real teeth, though.
Yes, those are real, unadulterated teeth, and she is getting that bliss point right there.
So thank you so much, Michael. So let's take some questions from the audience. We can just rotate sides. Why don't you go first, sir?
Okay. So if you had a magic wand and you could do one public policy thing, such as, you know, what Michael Bloomberg tried to do or whatever, but you couldn't do three things or five things, what would it be?
Well, as a reporter, of course, which I still am, being back at the Times, I tread very lightly on public policy matters. But I really do like the thinking of the White House to sort of sidestep the accusations of being heavy-handed on regulation and look at shifting, as I mentioned, the existing subsidies from heavily processed foods over to fruits and vegetables. I think if they can level the playing field in the grocery store on economic basis, then that will go a huge way to empowering consumers as we know more and more about what we really should be eating and want to eat to enable us to actually do that financially. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little about what is happening in school nutrition? They say that the younger generation is going to be less healthy. than we are. I wonder how much food has to do with that as well.
You know, I'm actually embarrassed to talk about this because my kids go to public schools where parents and teachers and the administrators are trying really hard to improve the school lunch. And because they're not there yet, we still pack home lunches for our kids. And I have a couple of really picky eaters. And so Will has been getting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches forever and ever. And his older brother, Aaron, for some reason latched onto hummus sandwiches early on, and there could be a lot of worse things he could eat. So we're really stuck. We're totally being bad citizens and good parents in
that sort is of so sticking. Embarrassing, Michael.
Well, it is because it's the problem is that, you know, if enough parents don't sign on to the school lunches, they won't get better. And it's just a quandary that you face individually, but that is the answer. And the important thing is that school lunches, the importance of good school lunches is for kids who don't have the means for a great home-packed lunch. And that's that is as important in leveling the playing field in education as much as giving those kids good teachers as well as, you know, other kids. So
I mean, the school lunches are often where the subsidized foods ends up, the corn and the
oh, yeah.
The dairy.
Oh, cheese. Yeah. Oh, boy, I've talked to school principals. They say, God, the cheese truck. And this is the shredded and the cubed and the tubbed cheese. You know, arise. We have so much cheese, we don't know what to do with it. And that's one of the things they started doing. We just like heaping it on the kids.
So, I mean, I'm aware of there's many experiments going on and efforts to make school lunches better, but sometimes I've read there are challenges where the kids aren't accustomed to eating healthful food and then don't have the taste for it then.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a societal, it can't just happen at school too.
Yeah,
so.
Or they'll throw like, you know, whole red delicious sort of pithy apples at kids and you just know those are going into the garbage can. You can't toss carrots and apples even when they're sliced at kids without some discussion, too. I mean, that's the other thing. Is you can't have a better school lunch without the home economics, nutrition discussion. If you don't engage the kids in the conversation and the thinking about it, they're just not going to, like, eat that stuff.
Michael Moss, the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 15th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org. 859 KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD. Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. University of Washington scientists have discovered another planet. Local virologists are tracking the latest flu in China, and the economics of studying science have led to some new ways to raise money for research. One Northwest Science writer explains what's new in science news tomorrow morning during the 9 o'clock hour. The border between the states of Washington and Idaho is like a petri dish for what the minimum wage does to the economy. That's where two extremes meet. Idaho has the federal minimum wage, $7.25 an hour. Washington's is nearly $2 more, the highest in the nation. You might expect that wage gap to send Washington border businesses fleeing to Idaho. But it isn't. An explanation tomorrow.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.